Welcome to this deep dive, where we extract the most important nuggets of knowledge from fascinating sources. Today, we're plunging into Erik Erikson's profound work, Gandhi's Truth, on the origins of militant nonviolence. Our mission for you today is to unpack something truly remarkable. How could an individual's deep psychological struggles and personal development lay the foundation for a revolutionary method of social and political change? A method that utterly rejects violence, yet remains incredibly powerful and, as Erikson puts it, militant.
It's such a compelling paradox, isn't it? Militant nonviolence. It forces us to reconsider what strength truly means. Erikson doesn't just scratch the surface. He really digs into how one person's intensely personal search for truth can evolve into universal principles that guide social action on a global scale. He challenges, you know, our very assumptions about how change happens.
Right. That truly reframes our understanding of power and strength. So Erikson's journey into Gandhi's inner world isn't just historical exploration. It's a deep dive into human consciousness itself, potentially offering a blueprint for a different kind of evolution. Okay, let's start unpacking how he arrives at these groundbreaking conclusions. To truly appreciate this work, we need to understand the unique lens of its author, Erik Homburger Erikson. You're probably familiar with his groundbreaking insights on the identity crisis and his 8 stages of psychosocial development, which reshaped our understanding of human growth. But his work on Gandhi goes beyond theory. It's a deeply personal exploration. What made him the ideal psychohistorian for the subject?
Well, his background wasn't just academic. Erikson was a pioneer in ego psychology, focusing on how individuals build a resilient sense of self across their entire lifespan, mediating internal drives and external reality. And this, combined with his unique ethnographic work among cultures like the Sioux and Yurok, gave him an unparalleled understanding of how profoundly cultural context shapes identity. He could see how Gandhi's diverse influences weren't just disparate elements, but foundational to his integrated self. Plus, Erikson himself grappled with profound identity struggles as a Danish-German-American immigrant and spiritual seeker. This outsider-insider perspective, combined with his personal pilgrimage to India to conduct research and interviews, meant he approached Gandhi not just as a subject, but with a deep, empathetic understanding.
So he's bringing his own experiences, his deep psychological insights, and his cross-cultural understanding to bear through his unique methodology, which he termed psychohistory. It's an approach that examines how individual psychological development isn't just a private affair, but actually intersects with and profoundly influences major historical forces.
Exactly. The book's central thesis is that Gandhi's Satyagraha, a concept he developed, often translated as truth force or soul force, which Erikson frames as militant nonviolence, wasn't merely a clever political strategy. Instead, it emerged from a deep psychological integration of Gandhi's own personal identity crises, a synthesis of different cultures, and his spiritual development. Erikson argues that Satyagraha was, in its essence, a profoundly personal solution to Gandhi's own inner conflicts, which then became a universal solution for social change.
That's a powerful core idea that Satyagraha wasn't just a political tactic, but a profoundly personal integration. So how does Erikson actually show this connection? Does he give us a grand, sweeping narrative, or?
No, he absolutely zooms in. To illustrate this intricate connection, Erikson doesn't just give us a sweeping overview of Gandhi's entire life. He zeroes in on a primary case study, the Ahmedabad textile mill strike of 1918. He uses this single event, as he calls it, as a kind of clinical magnifying glass to truly understand the origins and the practical application of militant nonviolence. It lets him examine the microcosm to understand the macrocosm.
You've laid out Erikson's framework beautifully. Now let's turn to Gandhi himself. How does Erikson begin to trace this psychological journey from his early life that eventually blossomed into his political power?
Right. He starts right at the beginning, highlighting how pivotal Gandhi's early life in Porbandar and Rajkot was. We see his relationships with his parents, his early experiences with truth-telling, and a particularly crucial, almost traumatic moment, the lasting guilt and conflict he carried from his father's death, which occurred while Gandhi was with his wife. Erikson suggests this deeply personal event, this internal struggle with guilt and responsibility, became a wellspring for his later moral framework.
So even in these early years, we're seeing the raw material for something much bigger. And then later, in London, Gandhi tried to mold himself into an English gentleman, right? Erikson shows this wasn't just a cultural experiment. It ignited a profound internal conflict, forcing him to confront his true identity and values.
Precisely. And the insight here is how this early, almost theatrical trying on of personas, this struggle between his Indian heritage and his desire to fit into Western society, became a crucial crucible for his authentic self to emerge later. These personal struggles with identity, with his own sexuality, with cultural displacement, all of this became the raw material that Gandhi would later forge into his revolutionary approach. It's not just about what happened, but how we processed it psychologically, transforming internal conflict into external resolve.
And this leads directly to his South African awakening. That famous train incident where he was thrown off despite having a first-class ticket and other experiences of blatant racial discrimination, these weren't just indignities. Erickson sees them as powerful catalysts for his identity integration and his very first experiments with organized resistance, like an ignition point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it was during these protracted struggles in South Africa that Satyagraha truly began to develop. Gandhi's personal experiments, things like changes in diet, celibacy, or his simple lifestyle choices, weren't separate from his activism. They were deeply integrated into a teachable philosophy of resistance, a way of living that mirrored his demand for truth and justice. And what's remarkable is his unique leadership style in maintaining nonviolent discipline among his followers, even under extreme duress. He was leading by living his truth.
Which brings us back to the event, the Ahmedabad mill strike of 1918, Erickson's magnifying glass. The context was straightforward enough. Mill workers demanding wage increases due to wartime inflation. But the mill owners, led by the powerful Ambalal Sarabhai, refused. But the dynamics were incredibly personal, almost like a drama playing out on a public stage. Gandhi was close friends with Ambalal, the mill owner, but Ambalal's own sister, Anasuya, was leading the striking workers. It's this really intricate web, isn't it? How did Gandhi navigate such a tightrope?
Well, that's where his method shines.
Yeah.
Gandhi initiated Satyagraha here by meticulously investigating the facts, formulating a just demand, a 35% wage increase, and then securing a solemn pledge from the workers to remain nonviolent and not return to work until their demand was met. He wanted to ensure their cause was based on truth and their methods on non-harm.
Right. And this is where the sheer psychological intensity of Gandhi's method really came to a head. As the strike dragged on, the workers' morale began to collapse. They were starving, on the verge of giving up or, you know, maybe resorting to violence. It was a critical juncture. Gandhi, feeling he had failed them, declared a fast unto death. Can you walk us through how Erickson interprets this seemingly extreme act?
Yeah, and Erickson's take is crucial here. He interprets this not as political blackmail, as some might see it, but as a deeply personal act of penance and self-purification. Gandhi was transforming suffering inward, taking the violence of the situation, the internal and external conflict, the potential for despair upon himself. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this fast was the ultimate tool of truth force, breaking cycles of violence by healing relationships, not by inflicting harm. It was about purifying the atmosphere, not punishing the opponent.
Wow. That transformation of suffering inward led to an incredible outcome. What was the immediate impact of that fast, both on the workers and on Ambalal Sarabhai?
Oh, the fast was electrifying. It shamed the workers, bringing them back to their solemn pledge of nonviolence and determination. But maybe more importantly, it placed immense moral pressure on Ambalal Sarabhai, who deeply respected Gandhi. Ambalal capitulated, leading to a compromise that respected all parties and prevented further escalation. It wasn't about one side winning. It was about finding a truth that all could accept.
And what's truly insightful, according to Erickson, is how these Ahmedabad strike dynamics connected back to Gandhi's childhood. He suggests that Gandhi's relationship with Ambal here was, in a way, reenacting the father-son dynamic from his own life. By fasting, Gandhi was resolving old psychological conflicts on a very public stage. So this raises an important question for us. Can we truly resolve external conflicts without first addressing our internal ones?
It's a profound thought that underpins much of Erickson's work. Yeah.
Okay, so pulling back a bit, what does this all mean for us today? What are the overarching themes and lessons Erickson wants us to take from Gandhi's journey and this concept of militant nonviolence?
Well, one of the core takeaways is definitely identity integration as the foundation of social transformation. Gandhi's remarkable ability to bridge seemingly conflicting aspects of his identity, Indian and Western, traditional and modern, spiritual and practical, made him a uniquely effective leader. It allowed him to understand and connect with diverse groups, which is, you know, crucial for any meaningful social change. It's about finding that unified self to present to the world.
And then there's the psychology of militant nonviolence itself. Erickson makes it incredibly clear that true nonviolence actually demands more psychological strength. than violence. It requires maintaining love and respect for your opponents, even as you absolutely refuse to accept injustice. That's a profound internal discipline, isn't it?
It really is. Mm-hmm. A mastery over one's own impulses. Another key insight is personal experiment as social method. Gandhi literally treated his entire life as an experiment with truth. His continuous self-examination, his willingness to admit mistakes, and to constantly change course based on his findings. That became the very source of his authentic moral authority. His personal development wasn't just a side project, it was his political strategy.
Uh-huh. And despite its roots in Hindu culture, Erickson argues for the universality of truth-seeking. The principles embedded in Satyagraha offer universal guidelines for human development and for resolving conflicts constructively, transcending specific cultural or religious boundaries, like a blueprint for humanity, not just one culture.
Exactly. Which leads us directly to some practical real-life applications and insights. For personal development, we can adopt Gandhi's experiment with truth through honest self-examination, reflecting on our actions, admitting mistakes, and ensuring our values truly align with our daily behavior. It's about constant self-assessment, really.
So for us, that could look like asking, am I really living up to what I say I believe?
Precisely. Then in conflict resolution, whether it's, you know, interpersonal squabbles or workplace disagreements, we can strive to understand our opponent's perspectives, seek win-win solutions that respect everyone's dignity, and maybe use voluntary sacrifice or compromise over coercion. Think about the energy that FAST generated without any violence.
Right, and for leadership development.
Gandhi teaches us to lead through moral example and continuous self-transformation, empowering those we lead through shared purpose and integrity, rather than just relying on charisma or, you know, positional authority.
Makes sense.
And finally, for social activism, it means emphasizing moral consistency and discipline in our movements, aiming to convert public opinion and even opponents to the truth of a cause, rather than just mobilizing an existing base. It's about changing hearts and minds.
The journey Erickson takes us on in Gandhi's Truth ultimately circles back to a vital lesson that truly effective social transformation has to begin with authentic personal transformation. It's an inside-out approach.
And to reiterate, nonviolence, far from being passive or weak, is the most demanding and ultimately effective form of conflict resolution. It requires immense psychological strength and discipline, and it consistently produces sustainable and transformative results because it aims to heal relationships and uncover truth, not destroy.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, consider this provocative thought. Can Gandhi's methods, as illuminated by Erickson's masterful psychohistory, truly represent a replicable model for human consciousness evolution? Can they help us move beyond the endless cycles of violence towards more mature forms of social organization in our complex modern world?
Erickson's unique contribution here, I think, is showing us that spiritual development and deep psychological integration aren't separate from effective social and political action. They are absolutely essential to it. It's a powerful testament to the idea that inner change drives outer change, and that our greatest struggles can be the source of our greatest truths.